Okay, so this was purely by chance that this, me and this sutra arrived on the 18th of December. But it's a pretty good chance, actually. Because, well, next Tuesday, this time next week, is going to be Christmas Day. And I've got the very sutra for us. So that we can enjoy it. It goes a bit crazy, doesn't it? But we want to enjoy it and not get crazy too. So, I like Christmas. I've been a Buddhist for 20 years and I still like it. So that's a bit of a confession, really. You know, I like the tree with lights on and I like Christmas carols and I like presents. I like pudding with 20 pences in. Used to be sixpence. I like all the wrapping paper getting all over the place and everything being just a really lovely mess. But there's also a side of Christmas that's not quite so easy, isn't there? There's the side of Christmas where, well, actually, we totally overdo the sugar and we probably overdo the alcohol and we just plain eat too much, talk too much, and we're with people that we really care about and we probably get irritated with them and they probably get irritated with us, and before we know it, we're behaving like a two-year-old. So, if this is at all familiar, okay, we've got some strategies for you. It's fantastically useful to catch yourself being a two-year-old, actually, or even a 12-year-old, because you've probably got those tendencies in a slighter form all the time. But at Christmas, people really know how to press those buttons, and there you are. Oh, that's what I do when that happens. So there you go. There's always something good in there about those uncomfortable times. The other thing, of course, that happens is it's really difficult to keep up with our meditation practice. It's well nigh impossible, actually, isn't it, if you're staying with other people and there are small babies waking you up in the middle of the night and goodness knows what, and no one else is meditating, and you've probably had a drink anyway, so your mind is a bit all over the place. So just be aware of that. Just be aware that that has a consequence, actually. And, yeah, don't tick yourself off. That's useless, isn't it? But notice that that's hard. That's different. I mean, if you're around Sheffield and, thanks to Vidanya's plug, you can come to the centre every morning, well, that's great, isn't it? You can then have a foot in your practice. But maybe you're away from Sheffield. Maybe you're immersed in family and friends who don't know what you're trying to do. So it's good to think about it, how you're going to manage it. And I've put it a bit negatively, but obviously it's such an opportunity. It's such an opportunity to be generous, to think of, well, what will please your family rather than, oh, it's not going quite how I like it. What will please, you know, you pick presents that you think will give them pleasure. You want them to be having a good time. It's a good opportunity to practice patience, of course. But it's also a good opportunity to practice metta, to practice mindfulness, to get hold of that mindfulness and not let it get too far away from you. Okay, so I'll go to the sutra now. This is a sutra from the middle-length discourses. It's a lot of sutras in the Pali Canon that we've been looking at this term. So the Buddha is talking to monks. He's talking about to monks 2,500 years ago in India, in rural India. So it's not that much like Sheffield in the 21st century. But he actually has quite a lot to say that's just on the button for us, really. Because he's talking about how the monks relate to the world. How do they live in the world? They didn't have monasteries then. That came later. So they're not, their situation is not that dissimilar to ours. They were living in the world, they were relating to people all the time, but they were trying to support each other's practice. They had each other to some extent. And they didn't want to get overwhelmed by the villagers feeding them up in banquets and whatever, all the kind of things. It's not quite the same as us and our telly and our off-license on the corner, but they did have temptations. So this sutra is called the Bait, and it's quite straightforward, really. It's in two parts. The first half, the Buddha tells a story about herds of deer and the hunters that are out to catch them. I immediately started thinking of Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. Well, the Christians got hold of Rudolph. You know, we get four herds of deer. Okay. So the first half, he's talking about the deer and the deer hunters. In the second half, he's explaining how he's used that simile, because he's talking to us as Dharma farers. So it's set in the Jeta Grove in Sarvati, where a lot of the Buddha's teaching happened. And he begins by talking about deer trappers. He says they don't put out the bait, they don't put out the food so that the deer will enjoy life and they'll live to a ripe old age. They put it out so the deer will get excited, they'll get careless, and so they'll be easily caught, and I guess, killed. He actually says they get intoxicated, so I don't know whether that means they actually drugged the food, or whether they just got excited because they saw there was so much food lying around that they could have. I don't know. But so, a herd of deer come along and they do just this. They find all this food lying around. They go, whoopee, take no precautions whatsoever, walk right into the trap, eating their faces off, and the trapper just catches them, just like that. Very easy. Another herd, they're a bit more cunning. They've seen what happened to the first lot. So they think, oh, we won't get caught in that danger. And they say, suppose we all together, they're talking deer, these, suppose we all together shun that bait food, shunning that fearful enjoyment. Let us go out into the forest wilds and live there. So they go far off, which is fine. That avoids the difficulty. But by the end of the hot season, there's no food and there's no water. So they have to come down to the plains, presumably. By that time, they're weak. They haven't got much energy. They haven't got much resistance. So they just come down and they fall on this food that's laid out for them. So they're careless. They don't think this is dangerous. We knew it was dangerous. That's why we went away in the first place. And they get caught. The third herd of deer, we keeping count? Well, they've watched the other two, so they think, obviously, they'll manage better. They decide that they can live nearby, and they'll just be cautious. They'll just keep an eye out, and when they think it's safe, they'll just go and get some food. So now the trappers have to work out, well, where are these deer going to? They're obviously taking food, but where do they go? So they put out hurdles. This is quite an education. I don't know how to catch deer. So they put out hurdles in a big ring round where they're putting out the food. And I suppose what happens is that when the deer are running away, after they've had a good nosh, they knock over the hurdles. That's all I can imagine happens. So then the hunters think, oh, they've gone that way. And they can follow them and find out where they are and catch them. Okay, so three herds down. We come to the fourth herd, and they've been seeing all this, and the trappers try the same trick, but they can't track them. So I'll just read you a bit. Here we go, the middle length discourses. So they say, suppose we make our dwelling place where the deer trapper and his following cannot go. Then having done so, we shall eat food not unwarily and without going right in amongst the bait that the deer trapper has laid down. By doing so, we shall not become intoxicated. When we're not intoxicated, we shall not fall into negligence, and when we're not negligent, the deer trapper shall not do with us as he likes on account of that bait. Well, the deer trapper couldn't find them, and he said, these deer of the fourth herd are as cunning and crafty as wizards and sorcerers. They eat the bait laid down without our knowing how they come and go. So he tried the same thing. He put up the hurdles and thought he'd find where they were going. But they left no trace. Couldn't find them. They didn't knock over the hurdles. Where had they gone? Don't know. The trappers couldn't find them. They thought, well, we don't want to make too much of a racket because that'll scare off the other deer. So they just left them alone. So the fourth herd got away with it. Okay, that's the story. That's the story of the deer and the trappers. The simile the Buddha used. And straight away he explains it. And he explains what he means. So you can guess who the deer are. That's us. That's us trying to practice. And the bait that tempts us, is attachment to sensual pleasures. So it's not sensual pleasures themselves, it's the attachment. It's called kamaguna, I discovered through the notes in that book. And kamaguna are the five cords, so that the things that tie us. And kama is pleasure. So it's not pleasure itself, it's fine to take pleasure. But it's how it ties you up. And the trapper, well, the trapper is Mara. I don't know whether you've all come across Mara. He's the forces that lead us away from our meditation, from our practice, so that we forget what we're doing. We forget we're trying to understand how things are. We start behaving unethically. So often in the Pali Canon, these forces are sort of embodied, if you like, by this character called Mara. You don't need to take it seriously. He's not the devil. But he's sort of like that. He's somebody that traps us. And if you laugh at him, he's had it. He can't cope. So, but we'll talk about Mara because it's a simple way of describing that process. So that's the deer trapper. Is Mara, he's out to get us. Okay, so the first type of practitioners, like the first herd of deer, they're not wary at all of the material things of the world, and they're easily caught. Well, that's easy to think of our own examples, isn't it? You know, you think, oh, it's no harm in having one biscuit or one piece of chocolate or one pint of beer. It's the second and the third and the fourth that cause the problem, isn't it? It's sort of, we think we can just dabble, and then we just gradually get caught up, and we think, well, there's no harm in it. I don't want to be a killjoy, etc. Before we know it, we've got really caught up and forgotten that we're trying to be mindful. That's the main thing. So the second type, just see how beguiling all that is. All the things that we take pleasure in easily, like that. And they run fast in the other direction. They go up the mountain. Let me see. Because they go, they're probably a bit more extreme than us. I'll tell you what they say. Just a minute. Suppose we altogether shun that bait food and those material things of the world. Shunning that fearful enjoyment, let us go out into the forest wilds and live there. And they did so. There they were eaters of greens or millet or wild rice or hide parings or moss or rice bran or the discarded scum of boiled rice or sesame flour or grass or cow dung. They lived on forest roots and fruits. They fed on fallen fruits. Well, there you go. You're tempted. Well, you know, they did that for a bit, but eventually they just couldn't keep it up any longer and got hungry and came down, lost their sense of purpose. Losing their delight in meditation is another way of thinking about it. They'd gone up there, they wanted to practice, they were really serious, and they just couldn't remember why they were up there. It was just too hard, too tough, and they were flipping hungry. I think the way that we can sometimes go is that we think it's spiritual to be a bit kind of grim, you know, not enjoy things too much and, you know, not eat very much and not whatever. Well, it isn't spiritual actually at all. But I can see that the attraction for that, we think, well, I'm not going to, you know, be overindulgent and all the rest of it, so I'll go right the other way. Okay. So they get caught. They come down, they eat, and Mara's right there waiting for them. So I imagine, well, I'm feeling quite superior at this point. I'm thinking, well, I don't do that anymore. Maybe I did when I was younger. You know, I had a go at being a first herd and a second herd. I've had a go at both. But, I guess we've learned a bit, haven't we, not to be so extreme. We probably think, well, that's a bit foolish. So we have a balanced, sensible outlook, don't we? Yeah. We know how to practice effectively. But seriously, I do think we're probably more like the third type. You know, they've seen the perils of getting caught up in, you know, over-sensuality and over-asceticism, going to two extremes. And we probably think we can get away with living around, you know, the attractions of the world. We can take our pick, we'll be reasonably careful, and that'll be all right, we'll get away with it. Well, I'm afraid the Buddha said no. He said this third type still get caught. The trapper finds where they live. In other words, he finds how they think. And so he gets to them in their minds. He entraps their minds. He gets to their views. So they start puzzling. They start having all kinds of wandering thoughts, speculations. They wonder about the soul and about eternity and whether the soul and body are the same or whether the soul is one thing and the body is another. Things that we can't know and aren't that useful. In another sutra, I'll just find you another one, where the Buddha uses the illustration of the arrow to just point out that this isn't very helpful and isn't what he teaches. So this whole idea of wondering about things that you can't know. So he says, suppose a man were wounded by an arrow thickly smeared with poison, and his friends and companions, his kinsmen and relatives, brought a surgeon to treat him. The man would say, I will not let the surgeon pull out this arrow until I know whether the man who wounded me was a noble or a Brahmin or a merchant or a worker. And he would say, I will not let the surgeon pull out this arrow until I know the name and clan of the man who wounded me, until I know whether the man who wounded me was tall or short or of middle height, until I know whether the man who wounded me was dark or brown or golden-skinned, until I know whether the man who wounded me lives in such a village or town or city, until I know whether the bow that wounded me was a longbow or a crossbow, until I know whether the bowstring that wounded me was fibre or reed, or sinew, or hemp, or bark, until I know whether the shaft that wounded me was wild or cultivated, until I know with what kind of feathers the shaft that wounded me was fitted, whether those of a vulture, or a crow, or a hawk, or a peacock, or a stork, until I know with what kind of sinew the shaft that wounded me was bound, whether that of an ox, or a buffalo, or a lion, or a monkey, until I know what kind of arrow it was that wounded me, whether it was hoof-tipped, interesting one, or curved, or barbed, or calf-toothed, or oleander, All this would still not be known to that man, and meanwhile he would die. So that may be laying it on a bit thick, but the Buddha really wants us to see that wondering about things that don't help us practice, that don't help us just know ourselves better, are a waste of time, and they're worse than a waste of time. They take us away from what we could be reflecting on. And the end of this particular sutra, which is not the one we're talking about, don't mind me, he says what he has declared rather than all that, which is the Four Noble Truths. Suffering, the origin of suffering, the cessation of suffering, and the path to lead from suffering. And why he said that is because it's beneficial, it belongs to the fundamentals of the holy life, it leads to disenchantment, to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to nirvana. So that's just to give you a flavour of not getting into speculative views. That's why Mara wants to keep you in there, because it's a waste of your time. Well, I must admit, I thought, well, I don't spend too much time wondering about eternity and the soul and things like that. Maybe you do. Some people have that kind of cast of mind. But I certainly have views which aren't helpful. And I get those from the world. They're really hard to dig out, views, because I know they're right, don't I? Obviously, they've always been right. So, really, let me think. I was trying to think of some undharmic views that I know about. I suppose one would be that I've held on to tightly is that I actually can't change. You know, I'm just who I am, actually. I'm stuck with it. Now, that is totally undharmic, but it's a view that's very current in the world, isn't it? You know, that's who you are, you know. Or if you say to somebody, you know, that was a bit unkind, you'll say, oh, well, I like that. So that's a view, and it's wrong. It's nice to be able to say something's wrong, isn't it, and just know that you're right. Another view that's around in the world is the romantic ideal. You know, just find the perfect person and you'll be happy forever. That's around a lot, and it's probably not borne out by experience, but we still want it to be true. So we're influenced by these views all the time until we don't know that they even are views that could be challenged. And this is one of the main reasons why we meet together to discuss things. Because you don't know a view until you're sitting around in a discussion group and somebody frowns at you and says, really? Or maybe everybody's nodding, except one person who says, oh, I don't know about that. Why do you think that? And then you think, because it's true. You know, you don't know why you think it. It's so much part of you. So as much as we can, what we're trying to do is find those out, where they've come from. And are they in accord with the Dharma? I've been looking at some really old newspapers recently, and that's really fascinating, because what you read in the press now, you think you've got a handle on. I think I've got a handle on. I sort of think, oh yeah, I agree with that. Oh, that's a bit extreme. That's left wing, that's right wing, whatever. I think I know. I think I'm sort of above all that. Not influenced by it. But actually, if you read really old newspapers, they're completely balmy. You know, they're sort of banging on about things that we've seen through a long time ago. So the chances are that's true of, you know, 2007, really. It's just there's more of me in 2007 than there is in 1807. Okay, so the fourth type, the fourth herd, the fourth type of practitioners. Well, this is the one that the Buddha says is the only one that leads to freedom. So this type, they have a look at what the other three modes of practice, well, they've failed. So they decide, well, it's obvious really, isn't it, that what they've got to do is go where Mara can't follow them. That's easier said than done, isn't it? What does that mean? Because they're successful. They do it. But where is it that Mara can't follow? Where is it that this sort of, all our bad intentions, all our confusions, all our desires to do anything but practice, where can't it go? Well, in the words of the sutra, how can we blindfold Mara, become invisible by depriving Mara's eye of its opportunity, and cross beyond attachment to the world? I really like the idea of becoming invisible. Yeah. Well, the answer lies in meditation. The Buddha describes at some length the four levels of dhyana. That's four experiences of increasing pleasure in meditation. And I put them up much too small on this board because I couldn't get it all on. So I'll talk you through it. And why Mara can't follow is because he's not wise. He can't get into a mind that is in positive mental states, that is focused, that is not wandering, that is becoming wise. He has no hold on it. So where we are is in the Karma Loka up the top. It's the realm of sensuous form. So that's how we experience the world. We take pleasure in things that we can see, things that we can feel, smell, listen to, whatever. That's where we live, largely. And when we're meditating from here, we experience the hindrances, but we can get quite concentrated and still be in the Karma Loka, but we get concentrated. We get to what's called access concentration. From there, from access concentration, which we go into the next realm, if you like. So we're talking about experiences of meditation. And I'll just take you through it, but don't worry about it. So the next whole section is on the Rupa Loka. Loka means place. So the Rupa Loka is when form is getting much subtler. So there's still an experience of form, but it's purer, it's more subtle. And in the Rupa Loka, there are four levels of what's called dhyana, where the first level, you're still thinking, you still have thoughts, and you can still apply your mind to those thoughts. So you're very concentrated. Your mind is quite pliable. And you have a lot of experience of bliss, rapture and bliss. Rapture is the sort of more bubbly, physical feeling. And bliss is pleasure. It's sort of bigger feeling, quieter feeling. The second dhyana, the thoughts are dropping away. So you're just concentrated on the object of meditation. And you're still experiencing rapture and bliss. And the third dhyana, one-pointed, but the rapture has dropped away. So you're calmer, but incredibly happy. And the fourth dhyana is equanimity. You're completely equanimous about your experience, but very, very concentrated. If that wasn't enough, from that point, that's the sort of highest point of integration that you get to, that you can get to in meditation. You go on to what's called the Arupa Lokas, which is the realm of no form, or a very, very subtle form. And I don't know what I'm talking about when I get up this high, although I think I possibly have pinged in and out, if you see what I mean. So the first is a sphere of infinite space. So it's an experience you have of infinite space. It's not. I can't say anything more about it really. The next one is infinite consciousness. So that space is, if you like, filled with consciousness. And the third one is the sphere of no thingness, no things at all. And the fourth, of neither perception nor non-perception. So, I don't want us to get hung up on that and thinking, well, I don't know what she's talking about. I can't meditate. I think I'll give up now. What it is a description of what's possible, what people have experienced, what the Buddha certainly experienced, but what lots of other people have described as their experience of meditation. So it's more like, well, don't put a limit, but don't kind of frown and wonder whether, you know, which dhyana am I in? It's not that helpful. But just, it's a reminder of how much delight there can be in meditation if we give ourselves a chance, if we give ourselves the right conditions, and we keep going, basically. Where am I? Yes, in the sutra, the Buddha says, we will have this experience. If quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, the meditator enters upon and abides in dhyana. So if we just keep on going, we just give ourselves the best chance, there's no reason at all. Why would we be so special that we wouldn't have those experiences? And if you can do that, then, like the fourth type, they find lasting food, actually, don't they? They don't need to keep on going and looking for food because they found really nourishing food. They've found pleasure that sustains them. And they stay mindful. They stay positive. And so they stay free. Mara hasn't a hope with them. Well, coming back to us and Christmas, I'm not meaning to imply that you've got to eat rice cakes rather than Christmas pudding. No, it's a bad idea. No prezzies or having fun with your friends or whatever. No music, no dancing, crikey. It doesn't mean going through the world with your eyes shut, thinking, I'm a spiritual person, I must not enjoy myself. All that stuff's fine. It's just what we do with it. It's what we do with it. We so easily get caught up, don't we, and lose track. We forget what we're doing, we lose the plot. So what we need to sort of hang on to our purpose in life. We need to experience beauty. We need to experience pleasure in our lives. Otherwise, what are we doing? Some pleasures are safer than others, shall we say. So, for instance, taking delight in nature. You're probably not going to lose your mindfulness and go down the tubes. Taking delight in your friends, you know, reflecting on their qualities, just enjoying being with them. Taking delight in literature, in music, in painting, whatever it is, the arts that inspire you. And taking delight in reading the Dharma, practicing, meditating. Yeah. It's the crucial thing is to enjoy yourself but not forget what you're doing. Not forget that you have a purpose that other people might not understand but that you want to hold on to. Because we are trying to follow the Buddha. And he wasn't caught by Mara. He was described as the trackless one. And I'm just going to read you a bit from the Dhammapada, which describes the Buddha. Well, describes us potentially as well. Those who do not accumulate material or mental possessions, it's interesting, isn't it? Who thoroughly understand the true nature of the food they eat, and whose range of experience is liberation through the realization of shunyata and the unconditioned. Their path, like that of birds in the sky, is difficult to trace. He whose impurities are extinct, who is not attached to food, and whose range of experience is liberation through shunyata and the unconditioned, his path, like that of birds in the sky, is difficult to trace. Okay, that's us. So what I'm suggesting you talk about, think about, discuss, and I can find the questions that I wrote down. Got them somewhere? I do have them, Surimati, don't worry. Well, I've got two, really. So what strategies can we have so that we don't lose mindfulness over Christmas? So that we can enjoy ourselves but not lose the plot? So what would be useful to bear in mind? And the other one is, well, how could we enjoy life more? How could we take more pleasure in our spiritual lives, but in our lives, that's helpful to us? So how could you delight? What would your delight be in? Maybe in your meditation, but also in all kinds of other things. So let's talk about delight.
Thank you very much for your talk, Sir. It was really enjoyable. Very apposite for Christmas. So let's start with some smaller groups and discuss one or both of those questions. So, if somebody has recently finished an intermediate course, or if you want to,